Welcome to another episode of the Neil Damrell Show with your host, myself, Neil Damrell, founder of Damrell Coaching, bringing you simple and honest advice on all things cycling related, helping you to cycle faster and recover quicker. Plus, sharing my personal experiences on all things health, wealth and mindset. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. So welcome back to today's episode, and just before Christmas, I had the pleasure of interviewing Tom Cox. Now, Tom, I got to know through social media, and he has been a real inspiration to me when it comes to looking after yourself as a cyclist as you get older. He is now in his 70s, still cycling strong, still training hard all year round to beat his PBs, enter some races, and still win his age group. So it's a really good, insightful podcast if you're looking for some inspiration in terms of looking after yourself as you get older as a cyclist, and also how cycling has changed from Tom's experience growing up to what cycling is today. So really get stuck into this week's episode if you're looking for some inspiration, and let's get into today's show. Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show today. Really excited to talk to you and learn a little bit more about your story. But for people that don't know who you are and what you're about in terms of the world of cycling, can you just give everybody just a little bit of a breakdown of, you know, how you got into cycling, your history of cycling, what you do now within cycling, just to kind of give everybody sort of a good idea?
Yeah, well, I started riding or racing back in 1969, but there's a little bit before that. I started going out riding a bicycle, and I met people from the Farnborough and Camberley Wheelers. At the time, I was also doing a lot of running, you know, schoolboy running, that sort of stuff, county running, district running, but wanted to join the athletic club because I couldn't get the forms to join. And I met the cycling club when they were out, and they said, well, why don't you come and join us? So I joined them for a few rides. And then later that year, I turned up and started riding their evening 10s. Yeah. And that was the start of it. And I haven't stopped since.
What age were you when you started riding your bike and started doing that?
I suppose I've been riding my bike since I was about three. I used to ride a bike. My father used to work as a groundsman in Aldershot, and I used to ride backwards and forwards with him when he went to work. So I just used to tag along by the side. It was all done on the road. It'll show you how different the traffic has changed. Yeah. So I've always ridden a bicycle, but seriously riding it, it was, shall we say, late 14, 15 was when I really started to ride it in earnest, because I bought a bicycle from somebody who lived up the road and it had 10 gears and handlebar control and all the other bits and pieces. I remember buying it, I think, for about £15 or something like that. As I say, so I've just gone from there, really.
Yeah, good. What particularly got you involved into maybe taking it a little bit more seriously as opposed to just riding recreationally? Because obviously you started going into doing some races. What sort of led to that after starting riding?
It was a case of, yes, you used to go out on the club runs, and they were club runs too. One of the senior members of the club was always detailed to take the young whippersnappers out. And you got taught the ropes. They taught you how to ride with people, and generally told you all about the sport. And it came across as being interesting. It came across as being very inclusive, and the people were nice people. And I've never come across many cyclists who I don't actually like. Whereas in normal day-to-day work, you can think of, oh, don't like that person, or I don't like that. But within the cycling world, I think I can probably count the number of people who on one hand. So it was after you got, I suppose, taught the ropes and speaking with people, and there would always be this enthusiasm for, racing, and the club always put its promotion on. You were encouraged to assist. And there's this thing, when you're kids, you want to do things fast. And on a bicycle, to go fast just gave you a bit of a buzz. The other thing, too, and it's a really strange one, I was doing quite a lot of athletics, but it was all over so quickly. I mean, I used to do 1500 mile, maybe the steeplechase and cross country, but it was all over. You'd go to an athletics meeting with the school, and you'd be lots of sitting around, and you'd go out there for 4.5 minutes or something to do what you need to do, and then you'd come back. Whereas with cycling, it wasn't just the race. There was the warm up before the race, there was the race, then there was the after race banter and the comradeship and what have you. So it's a combination of all of those that really gets me into it. And as someone might said, unless you like riding a bike, you can't race. So riding a bike is fun. You've got to be able to enjoy the scenery, enjoy the people. You see more than you would if you were going for a walk. You go for a ride for an hour, scenery changes are completely different. Go for a walk for an hour and you might see the same thing for the whole hour. So yeah, I think it's the people that really got me into it.
Did it also the freedom of cycling as well attract you to the sport in terms of just how much, like you said, you can see, but also explore, especially when you're young? I know, same for me. You go for a explore around where you live, and at the time, feel like you've gone 50 miles, but you've probably only done like 10 miles. And as you're an adult, you obviously you can see that it's like a real adventure when you're younger, isn't it? So.
It is. And one of the things you used to be able to do is if, the parents would always say, I want to know where you are and what you're doing, what have you. And if you're out doing something within the town, you might only be a mile or two away. You go out on your bike and you could be 40, 50 mile away from home. And the perception is they'll worry about you 2 miles away from home. But when you're 40 or 50 miles away from home, they don't seem to care so much. So it gives you a sense of freedom as well. You're probably doing a lot more than you would have done, if you were lurking around on street corners or something at that same sort of age. So yeah, it's a freedom. People don't know what you're doing. You can see different things. You'll meet different people. And you come across other clubs as well when you're out doing things like that. So, and it's just a chance to be out there, be with yourself, be with the countryside, be with the weather sometimes.
That's right. Yeah. Very
Three or
true.
four hours in the rain, I'm not necessarily sure, but that can be just as much fun as a nice sunny day.
Yeah, it's true. And was there any particular people spot? You said you were cycling with your dad. Was your family quite active, or was there other people that inspired you in the sport, like when you got into the sport as well?
None of my family actually rode in any shape or form. My father played football at quite a good level. And the only reason he didn't turn professional was because of the wage limits at the time. So it was just sort of after the war. But I suppose the people that I suppose I looked up to when I first started, there's a guy called Ron Dowling who was with the Farnborough and Camberley, and he'd come round to the local schools to try and encourage youngsters to ride the JHS Series 10. And at the time, you used to ride for your school. You didn't ride for a cycling club. That's changed now. Now you can ride for a cycling club or your school. There's also another chap who you might see around, a guy called Brian Highgate, or commonly known as Sid.
Okay.
He's, I think he's 86 now, and he's still riding. He rode, I think he rode the Welsh 12 this year. He was going to ride the 24, but he started it, but there were a number of issues there. And when you sit back and you think, Sid was a mere youngster back in 69, and now here he is still riding, still as enthusiastic as he's ever been.
Yeah.
And here we are, I was just a schoolboy. I'm now retired. I'm in the same category as Sid. We're both pensioners. Yeah, and it was all those people within the club. We had a, all clubs have got their club fast man, as they say. And at the time, the fast man of the club was a guy called Ernie Bohr. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, but he was a, he looked very classy on a bike.
Yeah.
When you saw him pedaling, it was smooth, it was nice. He was a top 12 BAR man. And I know times have changed now, but he was a 4.8, 4.6 hundred man, and they were good times then. A sub hour ride was a good ride. And I suppose you looked at Ernie and you thought, oh, I want to beat you, Ernie, and so on and so forth. So it was, those are the sort of people that I grew up around. A number of them are still around. There's another guy called Ron Taylor. Now, Ron Taylor is one of those that always rides a bicycle everywhere. I don't even think he's ever driven a car. But Ron is one of those people in the club that the club can't live without. And I suppose there's sort of three people there that I used you used to look up to, because they were always there. They were always doing things, either racing or they were proper clubmen.
Yeah, that's brilliant. What was the sport like for yourself from like an entertainment standpoint when you were younger as well? Because obviously cycling's got so much bigger now over the last 10, 20 years, but still, it was still really big going back in the 70s and 80s, but maybe the exposure to it and the access to watch it was obviously li more limited, wasn't it? So
I think that when I first started, obviously, and it's always been a criticism of BBC, that BBC only ever seemed to show football and rugby. There wasn't Eurosport. So the only things you ever saw were snippets of cycle races. I think the first real, there's, is it a Sunday in Hell? And it features, I think it's a 76 Paris-Roubaix.
okay, yeah.
And I remember the club got hold of a copy of the thing. We had a club night showing that. And of course, you all heard about the classics, and you heard about the exploits, for want of a word. But as you say, over here, we were never able to see them. So it was only ever word of mouth about who was doing what. But cycling has always been a colourful sport and always been bright. Whereas today, of course, it's wall-to-wall coverage through, the various medium that we've got. So it is completely different.
Yeah.
So it's, it, is it better? Yes, in some ways it is, because at least you can see what's going on.
Yeah.
I think looking back, you're probably your own era is always better than the current era. Your There's always going to be the argument, is Merckx better than Peter Sagan or something like that? The answer is you can never compare.
Yeah.
paper Merckx is, and he probably would be just as good today as he was then. But things were different. He would ride every event was in the year, from sort of, I suppose, end of February through to October. So it is different. And I think you have to accept that it's changed.
Yeah. Was that like the kind of professional cyclist that you'd looked up to? Was that more like the kind of idolized cyclist at the time? There's always an element within each decade in there where at the moment, obviously, we're seeing Pogacar and Vingegaard, and there's been previous ones throughout the decades. But
yeah, I mean, just as I was starting, Jacques Anquetil was just finishing. And I remember seeing a picture. It was on one of the comics, and it showed a picture of Anquetil with Merckx. And when you look at it, it's almost like the 60s are giving way to people from the 70s. It's the next generation. There was always Rick Van Looy and the Red Guard, as it was known. They were sort of coming to an end. And of course, you go back a little bit further and then you've got Coppi. So I think everyone has their, should we call them heroes or stars? And they're probably around for about 8 or 10 years. And then although their career might be longer, but there's 8 or 10 years when they're probably right at their prime. And then they hand over to the next person.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at it and say, Merckx handed over to Hino. And I suppose Hino, with a couple of people in between, next thing we get is Miguel Indurain.
Yeah.
Do we mention Lance?
Yeah, it's still part of the culture. That era, regardless of what happened during that era, obviously it probably happened before that as well. But
oh, it did.
Yeah, I think it's just still a very, people just like to almost close the door on it and not talk about it because they feel, I know some people maybe are still comfortable talking about it, but he was the biggest inspiration for me to get into cycling.
Yeah, and
regardless of what happened, so.
I look at it and say, as everyone was doing it, was there any advantage in what he was doing?
Yeah.
I mean, EPO at one time was legal. And you're absolutely right. If you go back in history, there's a very good DVD. It's 100 Years of the Tour. And one of the early tour riders was a guy, I can never remember his first name, but it's called Pellissier.
Okay.
And he won the tour one year, and the following year his brother rode as well. And they abandoned on, I think, sort of stage 4 or 5 or something like this. And the comment in the DVD is quite pertinent because it said, we're giving up, we're packing up here today because the organisers have got such ridiculously long stages that the only way that you can get through these stages is on amphetamines and alcohol.
Yeah.
And that's in the 20s.
Yeah.
And something else, you know, that always springs to mind as well, we talk about drugs within cycling, but the 2012 Olympic 100 metres final, there were 9 athletes. And do you know how many of them had never tested positive for some substance in that time? The answer is there was one, and that was the winner, which was Bolt.
Really, yeah.
So if you want to look at it another way, all the sports have got their dirty elements to it. I mean, the Russians in athletics with the Tamara Press in the 60s, the East Germans, the Chinese, even to the point the Canadian Bill Werbeneck, the snooker player, used to take beta blockers, and there was a big argument about that for many, many years. And that's snooker.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's looking to take an advantage. Obviously, there's a tennis player, a female tennis player, just got banned, isn't she? For using the, I think it's asthma medication to try and get some advantage in terms of increased blood cell count and stuff like that, aid recovery. So I think everybody's probably still looking for an advantage based on maybe the demands that they're under because they're playing so much, riding so much. It's probably quite unnatural, isn't it, to be able to perform at that level consistently without that support, would you say?
I think so. You take a step back, and does that comment that the Pelissier brothers make, the demands from organisers and now probably the press and the media are saying we want more of this, to have more of it, they're putting such huge demands on the people that the people are having to maybe resort to something else to satisfy those demands. They then fall foul of it, and the next minute you've got the media blasting them, you know, every which way they've come. I don't know what the answer to it is. I don't agree with drugs in sport. I think it should be a natural ability that comes through, but we have to be realistic and say that, well, people will try anything that is legal to ensure that they can get the best performance out of their body. Yeah. A body's no different to an engine if you look at it. You know, we all know that we run our cars on petrol, but then somebody puts nitrous into it, you know. Yeah. What does it do? It blows the engine eventually, but you know, is that fueling a car with a drug of some description? I don't know the answer, and I'm sure if we're having this conversation in 25 years' time, I think we would probably, you know, still have our, you know, our questions about that side of the sport and every other sport as well that goes with it.
True. Yeah. Do you feel like in terms of like the tour and what's the demands being placed on pro cyclists now has got bigger in comparison? I know, because some of the stages, especially of the Giro, they're still really long, massive stages. And I know they're kind of managing their effort a bit more differently now, so they know a bit more about science and managing their bodies better. But they're still long stages, aren't they? Which, for entertainment purposes and viewer purposes as well, probably aren't always the best as well.
They are long stages, but if you actually want to look at it, I think the winner from the tour usually is about 83 hours, something like that. And I think Merckx's first tour win in 69, it was 109 hours or 105 hours. It was something around there. So you are looking at stages that are now considerably shorter than they were.
Yeah.
But yes, you're still asking people to ride, I suppose, if you want to average it out, 100 miles a day, every day for 21 days.
Yeah.
Which must put a load on the body. Yeah. But what is interesting when you see, if you follow certain riders on Strava, and you can, some of the pro guys put their stuff up, and you can, when you look down at it, if they're riding in a peloton, yes, they're riding, but their output is quite low. Now, that's, you know, they're pretty fit guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at it and you think, oh, low heart rate, you know, low wattage, and just sort of sitting there, sort of chuntering along. So it's only really the people of the leader that are really hammering it along, I think, and the guys in any form of break, yeah, which what could be 6-8 people, something of that nature. And then we all know that the next day, if they've been out on a break for a long period of time, they've probably not performing at their best the next day.
Yeah, exactly.
And the leader's pretty protected and sitting in there and just poodling along.
Yeah.
I think that they are just managing their bodies a lot better, which is helping. Let's put it that way. So I think shorter stages are making it more exciting, but you've still got a long, you know, the body's still got to take a bit of a hiding from that. You've only got to look at the weight of riders from the beginning to the end of the tour.
Yeah.
They go in light, they come out even lighter.
Just taking a short break from this week's episode just to say thank you very much for tuning in to the show. And if you've got 5 minutes and happy to lend us a little review over on Spotify or iTunes, wherever you listen to this podcast, then really help out the show, really help it to get to more people and grow our audience. So if you don't mind lending us 5 minutes of your time to lend us a review, then I really appreciate it. And let's get back into today's show.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in respect to managing their bodies now, the advance in sports science and how we manage our bodies has come on considerably. How have you managed your body in the time that you started cycling to where you are now? Because obviously you've gone through a lot in terms of knowledge that's obviously been accessed, and what we know about the body has changed so much in that time. How has that changed for you as well?
I think in some ways it's almost a difficult question to answer, and the reason for it is because I haven't had a break. You've just evolved with it. So in some ways I've got to sort of put my thinking cap and think, oh, what was I doing 50 years ago that I'm doing different now? I think it's always been the case of eat well, perform well. So that's true then as it is now. I think the difference, one of the differences now, some quality of some of the foods that you're eating can be a lot better. But then on the other side of the fence, there's a lot of processed stuff that's about. I mean, when we were children, you grew up and you ate, it was meat and two veg, which, if you look at it today, is probably not a bad thing to have. I remember being at it was a presentation by one of the nutritionists from Sky, and he said he was talking about food, its calorific output, and so on. And he was saying, you know, if you want a snack, a nice little meat and two veg here comes out at X amount of calories, and you can have two or three of those a day if you want to, quite happily.
Yeah.
I think that certainly from a food thing perspective, you know, eat good and eat healthily. I think some of the areas which have come on a long way is the ability to put back some of the salts that the body's losing through sweat, etc., and some of the recovery drinks that you're able to take now, which help, you know, rebuild the muscles once you've had a hard session. I mean, we all know that we're all probably carrying some small injury. In some cases, we don't even know we've got it.
Yeah.
Small tears and so on. So I think the biggest thing that I've noticed is that the amount of products that have come onto the market to help you aid recovery and to get you back onto the start line the next day as fresh as you can be.
Yeah. And how has the fueling changed for you in terms of how you fuel your bike rides? I know you're doing a lot of time trialing now, but when you started riding, what were the disciplines you were training for? You're doing a lot long rides, and how did you feel those rides in comparison to how you feel them now?
You're going to love this one. People only ever had one bottle on their bike or no bottles at all.
Yeah.
you fueled a ride by the cafe stop.
Yeah.
I always remember we went into a cafe in Hindhead, and I and I was only a youngster, and we went in, and I think we cleared every sugar cube that there was in the restaurant. Yeah, the difference is now, I think, you know, people will drink a lot more than they used to. There's an understanding of why you do it. I can't say how I know, but somebody I know was working to do with an issue in the forces regarding a couple of deaths that happened. One of them was on a very hot August time. And we were having a chat together, and he said, "Do you know what the difference is between over and under hydration?" I said, "No, I know what over under hydration will give me. It gives me a stinking headache and so on." And he said, "Actually, the symptoms are the same. And if people don't realise that, you know, when, for example, you end up with these issues in something like the London Marathon, where somebody unfortunately passes away, if you go back and look, they might have stopped at every feed stop there was and taken on a bottle every time. Are they overhydrated, which has caused the problem, and they don't realise it?" So I think from my perspective, looking at hydration is a thing. You always try and take the correct amount of hydration out. You try and monitor what things look like so that you can certainly put back what you've taken out.
Yeah.
And I know that some of the professional teams are given colour charts to
urine, yeah.
Yeah, so that they can tell. I think it's a case of you've got to understand what the body needs, and you've got to be look at putting it back in. But in the old days, dear me, you would not wanted to have known what was, because it wasn't thought of like that. Oh, go out for a ride. Oh, feeling a bit thirsty. Oh, we'll be stopping for a coffee in about 15, 20 miles. That'll be all right.
Yeah.
And it was a bit like that.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, pretty appalling, really.
Yeah. But I mean, I suppose it made you more resilient cyclist, didn't it? Because you probably had to dig a little bit deeper physically to, you know, achieve those rides in comparison to now. You probably feel a million, you could, if you had polar opposites from day one, if you did a ride back in, say, the 60s, 70s yesterday, and you did a ride today as it is today, the polar opposite and how you feel pre, post and during the ride would be a million times different, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably as a nipper, you'd come back in with a headache most times, which is probably a good sign that you haven't drunk enough. Nowadays, you come back and, you know, you think, oh, I feel fine. I could do that again.
Yeah.
And that's I think, is the difference. I always look at it and think, why can I still ride at a very similar level to what I was doing 40 years ago? And I think a lot of it comes down to understanding what the body's doing more now.
Yeah.
And making sure that you're giving it what it needs. You know, a steam train doesn't run without water and coal.
Yeah.
Body doesn't run properly without water and other fuel.
I was just going to ask you, based on that, you mentioned it there, but I was going to say, how have your times changed from the events that you're doing now compared to 20, 30 years ago? And is that solely down, would you say, maybe to the advancement in nutrition and what you've learned and adapted? Or is it, would you say, your training habits have changed as well alongside that?
Training habits have changed quite a bit. I went to see a friend of mine who coaches us now, 16, 17 years ago. And I said to him, "I think there's a bit more left. but I'm struggling with work, home life, and fitting everything in. Can you help us? Yeah, to think about it. I said, yeah, we think we can do something. And we ended up doing more, but we did things differently. We will do some of the training now is more specific. For example, we all used to in the 60s go out and do a chain gang. It'd be in the middle of winter. And I can remember one chain gang that we used to have that's left Frimley Park Hospital and went down to Egham, and there must have been about 40 people on it in the dark, in the cold, and they were all over the road. It was like a road race. Did that work? It was good fun. And yes, it did something, but really, did it work correctly? I don't think it did. Nowadays, if you were going to do some form of intervals of some description, they might be based on power output, looking at your wattage, and they would be very, very targeted, possibly even in most cases done on a turbo or the equivalent of. And I think you can train better within the zone that you need to train in now than what you could do 70s, 80s. I mean, turbos only came in, I think, in the mid 80s, something like that. And it was only Chris Boardman working with, I can see his face, but I can't remember his name for a minute. Is it Peter Keane? Started working with heart rate monitors. And then everyone got, and then someone said, well, yeah, but heart rate, that's not going to give you. The correct stuff, you need wattage. And then suddenly everybody's got power meters on their bikes, me included, and you can ride to them in that zone specifically, and I think that has aided some of the performances. And what's interesting is when you are around a result board now and people are having a chat, whereas in the old days it would just be a general chin wag, you can hear people in the background saying, oh, well, I was a bit down on my wattage today. I was aiming for this and I was aiming for that and I never got there. So it's obviously got a knock-on effect everywhere else. So, yes, I think it's been a number of things that have kept me riding at a similar sort of level for so many years. The only downside for me is I did suffer a, rupture in my Achilles at 65. It's not a thing I'd recommend to anyone because that is a difficult one to come back from. Not just the injury, but also regaining the performance level that you want to do. Because if you're continually doing something, you're able to continue hit the numbers, you have that dip and you're trying to recover, it does have quite an impact on you.
Was that an injury through cycling, or did that just, or just wear and tear? Or?
Neither. It was stepping off a curb to go to the car. It was a bus curb, so it was, what, 14 inches deep.
Oh, you
I
know,
think I caught my heel on it as I and stumbled. Didn't know that I'd done it. Although I did hear somebody say, ouch, are you all right? I thought, yeah, because I never actually fell over. But I think I must have literally gone beyond its elastic limit. And when I looked down, I saw my foot stuck up in the air. I thought, oh, that's a bit strange. I just used the other one and pushed it back down and carried on.
Oh God.
No, but that's a difficult one to come back and say totally unrelated. And that's the longest period of time I've ever had off my bike, which was whilst I was having that operated on.
Have you seen, so you said your biggest benefit that you've noticed in terms of why you can still cycle so well at your age now, if you don't mind me asking, how old you are now, Tom?
I'll be 70 soon.
Yeah, which is amazing. Will be down to the fact that you've consistently, apart from obviously that injury period, you've never stopped cycling. Would you say that's the biggest hurdle that some people have, is that they maybe cycle a lot in certain periods of their life and then have a break because family, work, commitments, and then they're trying to get that fitness back, and it's always more of an uphill struggle because they have that period where, and it could be quite a significant period where they're not exercising or looking after the body as well as they could have done in that time.
I think there's a big element of that.
Mm.
I mean, one of the reasons I've not had a break is because people didn't used to have two cars. So when you went to work, you rode to work.
Yeah.
And that might be, 25 miles each way. So you're getting 50 miles a day in. So you
Yeah.
might just as well race. So that's helped. But I think it's for me, it's got to be the fact that I enjoy riding my bike. So that's meant that I've continued to do it, and I've evolved with the sport, and
Yeah.
it's gone different directions. It's also meant you've got to be disciplined with yourself as well. By that, I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. It doesn't even enter into my head that I've ever wanted one. I've never missed it. Yeah, I know a lot of cyclists will have a drink. I don't personally, because it actually upsets me. It gives me, if I had a glass of wine, I would be afraid you'd lose me for the rest of the evening. It just gives me a stomach cramp. So I don't bother with it. Doesn't mean to say I don't go into a pub with people, enjoy being there. It's just, it doesn't do anything for me. So whenever you see anything on the In the media, they're always saying, you need to be, should we say, you've got to do things in moderation. So I think that that has helped. In
Yeah.
fact, I don't know if you can hear an awful noise. Can you bear with us a minute? I can
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
turn off. Sorry about that. Something turned itself on.
That's fine. I can cut it out. Anyway, that's fine, Tom. But you just carry on, yeah. Understand, and just to know a little bit how you sort of manage your health day to day around cycling and just in general, just to keep your body feeling fit and healthy at your age, where a lot of people, I would even say younger than you, I'm 40 now, in worse condition in terms of how they look after their bodies these days, then it would be maybe even at that age. So at your age.
I suppose for me, my day is, shall we say, I call it regimented. It's not really. But I get up, and the first thing I do is I do whatever training I've got to do. Now that fits in with family life because I've got a disabled wife who suffers with ME. So that means that she needs to rest. And in the morning, she's not at her best. So hey, great. I can get out and ride on a bike quite happily. So I think I've got into this routine of doing that. So I'll come back and have done whatever I need to have done by late morning, something of that. And then I've got a chance. I don't stop when I'm training. If I'm out for a ride, I carry on. If I want to have a coffee stop, then what I do is, when I get back home, I'll take the wife out to make sure that she gets out, and I'll have that coffee stop then by driving the car out. But the other way I look at it is I need to keep myself fit. I couldn't do what I have to do for my wife if I wasn't fit. I wouldn't have been able to do what I did at work if I wasn't fit. So how many times, and I'll pose this one back to you, have you ever walked up the stairs with somebody your own age who's probably, should we say, a few stone overweight? when they get to the top of the stairs, all you can hear is this deep breathing noise. And there's something about feeling fit. You can actually feel better. And so, yeah, that's an enormous driver as well. It's like, I know people of my age, oh, I can't go out and ride 2 days on the trot. And I say, well, why can't you do that? So, oh, I just can't do it. There isn't a word as can't. You can get out. You can do it every day. Just some days you just got to temper what you're doing. I think Coppi once said it, you know, for every hard mile you do, you've got to do one easy mile.
Yeah.
And when you get older, that's the most difficult one, because, you know, 20 years ago, I could go out and bang really hard rides back to back. Yeah, I can do two or three hard rides really back to back, but you need to be at a recovery. So now maybe you do the hard ride and the next day you go out and you do a really easy ride. And then sometimes there are rides we call take the bike for a walk. So you're just sitting there, hardly turning over, but it is, you know, it is helping the body to recover, do things. The other thing is too, although I hate it with an abandon, is the gentleman who coaches me wagged his finger at me one day and he said, you're not getting any younger, so we're going to get you doing some stretching.
Yeah.
And I suppose there are probably minimum of two, but three quite often, you know, proper stretching sessions that take place during the course of a week.
Yeah.
And you can actually feel your body feeling better once you're doing it. If you'd asked me that 20 years ago, I'd say, oh, no. And I'm probably more flexible now than I was 20 years ago, because that wasn't something that was considered. And you didn't think, oh, a bit of stretching will help me recover. So I think it's looking at everything in moderation. Saying that, I'm like any cyclist. I will overdo it. I know I overdo it. And when you do overdo it, you feel pretty rotten for doing it, which is why I've got somebody telling me what to do, because I can tell you what to do, but I can't see what I'm doing wrong. And that's something else within cycling. You never stop learning. The day you stop learning will be the day you might as well pack up the sport, because at that point, you're too big for your boots, really.
Yeah.
I was going to say, someone, I've often looked at it, you start at the bottom, you rise to the top, but you're going to end up where you started.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't cheese anybody off on the way up, because you'll meet them on the way down and they'll get their own back. But it's actually true, you know. You see pictures of riders who were your heroes as kids, and now they are, you know, still riding, but older riders.
Yeah.
You know, they still got it here. They haven't got it in their legs anymore.
Yeah.
But it's their love for the sport, which means they carry on riding a bicycle.
That's right. Yeah. Going back to how you're looking after your body, would you say recovery and focusing on that more has helped you? And maybe is that something you find maybe in your social circle or other people you know within cycling struggle to do, because obviously they enjoy riding their bike so much, that element of looking after their body is something that they don't prioritize enough, would you say?
Oh, they don't. I've got a friend of mine who's always got an injury of some description, and you know damn well that the problem that he's got could be resolved by looking after himself a little bit better. He could benefit a huge amount from stretching, and if you'd see him, you would probably completely agree with that assessment. But he doesn't do it. He doesn't race anymore. He rides for the fun of riding. But then he'll moan, oh, I couldn't do this today and I couldn't do that. And I said, well, why don't you stretch out a little bit, you know, because he'll moan, oh, I've got backache or I've got this. They just don't, they don't get it. My generation, 80 plus percent of them do not understand how to recover and what you can do yourself. It's not all about, you know, you can't go to a physio or a masseur and they're going to resolve your problems every time. They are just one of the tools that you can use to help, but there's a, they're only going to give you the top 20% of that help. The 80% is in your hands. And my generation are particularly bad at that, I think. You know, they won't do it. And that's borne out too by things I hear from where my wife works in a little volunteering job at Age UK. And there, you hear things about people in their general life and you think, why? You know, and then you hear what they're not doing, and what they're not doing is doing anything proactive to look after themselves.
Yeah.
And it's, that's very, very important, especially when you get older.
Yeah. And any age, isn't it? But just because you build those habits like you've done all your life, so that way what you do now is a normal routine for you. It's not a chore because you've built this routine and they're just normal habits that you implement on a daily basis.
Yeah, it is. And isn't life, a lot of things you do in life is very repetitive, you know. But you know, you have to consider what you want out of life. So the fact that I am fitter, the fact that I do hope, touch wood, that I take care of myself, does mean that I can do more and I get more out of life than maybe somebody, you know, 10, 15 years younger than me.
Yeah.
And surely that's the aim in life, really, is to be able to enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah. And for as long as possible, yeah.
As long as possible. And there are, I mean, there are other people who I know who are well into their, well, I can think of one person, he must be sort of 90 now. He's still doing regularly 45, 50 mile rides.
That's amazing, yeah.
He went to the Olympics in 64 in Tokyo. But he, again, he's ridden all his life. He hasn't raced for a long time.
Yeah.
But he still rides his bike, you know. And if you looked at him, you'd say, 90? Certainly, you know, looks in his late 60s.
Yeah, it's great, yeah.
And I think also something else that's been another boon for some of the older riders, and I'm thinking of one, I won't mention any names, but he was a professional in the 60s and he's in his 90s and had to start going out riding by himself because he just couldn't keep up with people. And he got hold of an electric bike. The mind still had all that knowledge and where he needed to be. Great boon for him, because what it's meant is he can now go out with a group of people, and that meant that he's now got his social life back again.
Yeah.
And the social life and keeping the mind active means you keep the mind active, the body's active, and it gives you that outlook because you're with people.
Yeah.
And younger people, people of all ages, you mix with them, conversations, and you stay young in mind.
Yeah, it's a big element in terms of longevity, isn't there, with community and just being around people. And cycling is such a good community where you can get out and ride with your friends and have a chat. That's such a vital thing to maintain, isn't it?
Yeah, and there is an element within cycling as well that you can go out riding with somebody and they could be 50 years younger than you. But the one thing you've got in common, you're both sitting there on that bicycle. And you can have a conversation about anything and everything. And sometimes a younger rider would be interested in things that have happened sort of 40, 50 years ago and some of the history of cycling itself. And of course, there's the present day stuff because you're in that as well. So it does become a really interesting sport as well. And even for people who don't understand cycling, you know, if you're looking at the equipment and everything else that people using, so even if you don't want to ride a bike, sometimes even having a conversation about the aerodynamics of, you know, way things are built and why things are built to a non with a non-cyclist is really interesting, and it becomes, you know, a conversation piece in its own. So you're out there, I don't know, a social evening, you know, having a meal with people, and they'll talk about things to do with riding, maybe not riding itself or cycling because they're not interested, but you know, there are other spin-offs as well, which again, you're having a conversation, you're keeping your mind active. Active mind means active body again.
That's right. Yeah, it's brilliant. Just want to wrap things up a little bit now, Tom. I want to just quickly touch on the bit about you mentioned having a coach. And obviously, you've had a coach for a long time and continue with that. What would you say to people listening have been the biggest benefit of having a coach? Because some people, you know, I'm a coach that support other amateur cyclists, and whether that's for a small period of time, for an event, or maybe a longer period of time. Obviously, that depends on the individual, but what do you think coaching has brought to your cycling, and how has that benefited you over the years?
What it's brought to me is it's brought the ability of somebody to look inside and tell me what I'm doing wrong. And you have to trust that person. And if that person is giving up their time to coach you, you should do what they're telling you to do. And that element of trust takes a bit of time to get, but you trust that person, you do it, and the rewards do come. I think it's been instrumental in what I've done. I mean, the only way of looking at it is over what 15, 16 years, excuse me, that I've been working with him. We've had five national 50 age group wins, a national 100 this year, which is the first age group title I've had since the Achilles. But then there was the circuit champs. There's been three Welsh hundreds, two Welsh 25s. Now, that is just trusting that person. And he's become a good friend, as has his family. And so it's, and I've supported him in events, you know, when he's ridden 24s, 12s, and other non-cycling events as well. But it's the biggest thing for for anyone wanting a coach is one, why did you, to ask the questions, why did you ask somebody if they would coach you? Because you wanted to get better. So what you've got to do is put your trust in that person, that person can see what you're doing wrong. And you've got to respond back to that coach by doing what they say. And I know when I'm working with Sean, he said, I know that if I tell you to do this, this, and this, 95% of the time you'll do it, everything. Sometimes there are times when maybe I'm just feeling too jaded for some reason. And there are things because of what I have to do with looking after somebody. That has an effect on you as well. But that's very few and far between. You know, it's that mindset, believe in, trust, and it will come.
What do you think is the biggest barrier for people to have a coach? Because there's so much information that you can almost self-educate yourself now as well. So what maybe, you know, what's your opinion on, or people that you've spoken with or know that be with their resistance of having a coach, but in particular?
I think the biggest thing is if you think you can interpret everything to get you to win, you're a very lucky person. because 9 times out of 10, you cannot see what you're doing wrong. The other thing is, as a coach, if you tell me I need a day off, I will do that. But if it was me self-coaching myself, I would probably say, oh, no, I need to train even harder and actually make things worse. So I think one of the things, the important things the coach brings to the table, he brings with it the ability to put things into perspective, whereas you as a rider, it's too close to you and you can't see the wood from the trees. And it's say that to anybody, trust them, and that's the thing. You've got to give. It's easy at the end of the day. You just do what you're told. It's dead easy. You don't have to think about it. And that's quite nice. And in fact, what that does do, it relieves the pressure as well. You know, and you can discuss things. You know, why didn't I go well? And then they say, well, look, you did this and you did that. If you hadn't have done that, you'd have been all right, you know. And that might not just be with riding a bike. It might be something, because I'm looking after a disabled person, you know, it's putting things in perspective.
Other life commitments.
And I will quote something that Sean says to me. He says, I know you better than you know yourself. And he'll tell us things and say, you're feeling like this, aren't you? I say, yeah, how do you know? Ah, well, I know. You know, it's invaluable. Whether you need it in normal, if you're just going out enjoying riding a bike, I'm not so sure. But if you want to do any form of competition, it is the most important commitment that I've ever made, is to listen to what that coach has said.
That's brilliant. And have you got any events coming up? I know we're going into winter now, but how's this year been, and you got any exciting events coming up again next year in the summer?
I want to have once I come back from Spain, I'm going out there, I hope, in the next couple of weeks. As soon as my passport comes back, I've then got to spend 183 days there. The plan will be to come back and then to race, see friends and family. And I think I've got this aim. I want to be able to give every one of my grandchildren one of my age group medals. And my two lads and their prospective wives. So I've got a way to go still.
Good goals to have there.
And it's a goal, you know. You say, right, I want to achieve that. You know, and if I achieve that, then there'll be something else to put down. You know, I've just finished this season and I'm thinking, it's only like 183 racing days to the start of the next racing season.
Yeah, that's good. And you're looking forward to some good winter training out in Spain as well.
Yeah. The fact that you can go out in most days and it's nice weather, that's going to be the biggest boon. Not like now. As soon as it rains, the roads are going to be damp now for probably to February. It's going to be dark. Yes, it's going to be dark in Spain with exactly the same daylight sort of hours, but you can go out of an evening and have a walk and it's still warm. We were out there in March and they had the coldest day they'd ever had, they'd had for about 5 or 6 years. It was 8 degrees. I saw a photograph from the lady that I've been helping today, the other side of the road, and she sent me a picture and everywhere was white. It puts it in perspective, really. And I think a couple of days after that, the temperature was about 24 degrees.
Perfect. Definitely is the way forward for most people. I think getting that warmer weather as well, you just feel much more better for it, don't you? In terms of less aches and pains as you get older, and it's just more comfortable.
I mean, there's two reasons for going. Is one, I don't like this country when it's damp. When it's sunny, you can't beat it, but when it's damp, it's horrible. So there's a health benefit for going. There's a health benefit to my wife as well, because her joints start aching in this sort of wet, damp weather. And although it doesn't improve the condition at all, what it does do, it relieves some of those aches and pains, so it lifts the mood as well.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
So it's good stuff.
That's good.
Big, but again, big commitment at this time to suddenly up sticks and run out there.
Know, but it's another exciting adventure to look forward to, isn't it? So it's look at it like that, isn't it? It's just another chapter in your life. So
Yeah, it is, you know. Which just proves, you know, something, you're never too old to try something.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's
Yeah.
good. Well, we'll do wrap this up now, Tom, but I've really enjoyed having a chat with you today. It's been fantastic, and thanks for sharing all of your insights and wisdoms over the last
Well, I'm
year
not
as
sure how
well.
much wisdom, but.
Plenty of wisdom for everybody, for sure, in terms of just, shining an example of how you can maintain your health and still enjoy cycling long into retirement and later on. I have plans to keep cycling for as long as I can. So I think as long as you look after your body from any
Yeah.
age, and the earlier you do that, the easier it's going to be, isn't it? So.
Is and I think if you get into it, into some form of sport when you're at school, that and you can stay with it, it stays with you for the rest of your life, and it's the biggest thing you can ever do to keep you physically, mentally, and everything else on the straight and narrow, really. You know. It does
Thanks.
mean you can have that extra sticky bun as well when you're out with the guys on the ride.
Yeah, that's the whole point. That's why you do it, so you don't have to worry about
Yeah.
the extra calories coming in. So if anybody listening or watching wanted to sort of follow your journey and see how any results, I don't know if you post anything on Strava or anything like that, I can put them in the links if people want to follow you, or if you're happy for them to do so. Is that something?
By all means, I don't have a problem. You know, I think my Strava profile is, I haven't got it protected in any way. You know, by all means, I don't have a problem with that at all, Neil.
Brilliant. But just nice people follow people's journeys, and I'm sure you're going to be an inspiration to many people as well. You are to me, for sure, in terms of how you've gone about things, which is, commendable, and really, I think, a great advocate for the world of cycling.
Oh, I appreciate that comment. Thank you. You know, that's it's always worth. It's always nice to hear something like that. So thank you very much for that, mate.
It was always great chatting to you as well. And thanks for your time today, coming on the show, and just having a nice chat and getting to know a little bit more about your story, and how you've managed it over the years, and the world of cycling, and the gems that you've shared today. So thank you very much.